This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. I'm Michael Walker, and on this Wednesday evening, I'm joined by Dahlia Gabriel.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
I am very well. You're looking... This is a very nice setup, very traditional. I was going to say hi, I said bouquet, but that would be a bit offensive, wouldn't it? I mean, it's lovely.
My birthday hydrangeas.
Oh, gorgeous. Coming up later tonight, something which smells a lot worse than hydrangeas, England's waterways. And they're overflowing with more sewage than ever, or at least than ever since we started recording it. Another bad story in terms of things being worse than since records began, and refers to the NHS. People are less satisfied with it than ever. And Israel have officially fired Alon Levy. We're going to be looking at some of his worst moments, really, because I do think it is quite telling. Do stay tuned for all of that. Straight on to our first story. Benjamin Netanyahu has spoken out publicly for the first time about the UN Security Council vote for a ceasefire in Gaza. The American abstention on that vote meant that the resolution passed, and it's been seen by some as a sign that Washington is losing patience with Netanyahu's war. In response, the Israeli PM cancelled a planned Israeli delegation to the United States, a move clearly intended to signal his displeasure at the Americans' change in stance. But Netanyahu has met with US Republican Senator Rick Scott in Israel and said there was a different target for his snub.
The US decision on the Security Council, very bad. The worst part about it, I think the bad thing about the US decision in the United Nations Security Council was that it encouraged Hamas to take a hard line and to believe that international pressure will prevent Israel from A, freeing the hostages, and destroying Hamas. And that, therefore, my decision not to send the delegation to Washington in the wake of that resolution was a message to Hamas. It was a message, first and foremost, to Hamas. Don't bet on this pressure. It's not going to work. And I hope they got the message.
So he's saying, this wasn't me snubbing an ally, right? This wasn't just to put up two fingers to Joe Biden. This was to send a message, not to the Americans, but to Hamas. We won't respond to any international pressure. Now, maybe you're sending that message to Hamas. You're also sending that message to the rest of the world. We, Israel, a supposed member of the international community, will not pay any attention to what any country, however close they are to us, however much of an ally they have been to us, we will ignore them if what they want us to do is limit our genocidal war on Gaza. That's essentially what he's telling the world. Despite the UN Security Council demanding an immediate ceasefire, of course, Israel has continued to bomb Gaza. In the last 24 hours, several residential areas have come under attack in Rafah, where around two-thirds of Gaza's population are now trapped. 24 people have been reported killed, with most of them thought to be women and children. Rafah is overcrowded and without the infrastructure to support 1.5 million people. As a result, conditions are deteriorating fast. A spokesperson for Save the Children told Al Jazeera, "This overcrowding is the first thing that you can notice. There are people everywhere. There are children with rashes as communicable diseases are spreading. We have seen children with one or both limbs missing, and many are malnourished as nowhere near enough food is getting through right now." Israel's military assault on Gaza has resulted in over 32,000 Palestinians being killed, with many thousands more now at risk of famine. And those figures are making an increasing number of British politicians anxious over the UK's culpability in supplying arms to Israel. Shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy has called on Foreign Secretary David Cameron to publish the government's legal advice on whether Israel is violating international humanitarian law. If the legal advice says Israel is committing war crimes, that should trigger a ban on arms exports. And Labour MP Zara Sultana has coordinated a letter to the Foreign Secretary, which has now been signed by 107 MPs from opposition parties and 27 peers. So the letter says this: business as usual for UK arms exports to Israel is totally unacceptable. Both domestic and international law require the government to prevent the transfer of military equipment where there is a clear or overriding risk that such exports might be used to commit or facilitate a serious violation of international humanitarian law or international human rights law. But UK-made weapons are being used in Gaza. For example, the government grants licenses for parts of Israeli F-16 fighter jets. According to a United Nations investigation, it was likely one of those jets made with UK parts that in January bombed British doctors at a compound in Gaza housing an emergency medical team from the International Rescue Committee and Medical Aid for Palestinians. Now, it's not just the UN that's been investigating Israel's bombing of medical personnel. Sky News has published its own investigation into a separate attack on Médecins Sans Frontières, or one of their aid shelters. 64 people were sheltering in the building when it was hit on the night of the 20th of February. Two family members of MSF workers were burned to death in the fire that ensued. Several more were injured. At the time, Israel denied being involved in the attack, but using ballistics experts, footage filmed at the time, and witness statements, Sky News have now said that the blaze was caused by Israeli tank shells. Now, that's despite the fact that MSF had given the location of their building to the IDF as part of standard deconfliction procedures. In response to the Sky News report, the IDF said this: during occupational activity in Khan Yunis, the IDF forces fired at a building that was identified as a building where terror activity is occurring. After the incident, reports were received of the death of two uninvolved civilians in the area. The IDF regrets any harm to civilians and does everything in its power to operate in a precise and accurate manner in the combat field. As part of the lesson learning process the IDF conducts during the combats, the IDF began an examination of the incident. The IDF has not produced any evidence for their claim that Hamas activity was taking place inside that MSF building. But then the Israeli government never seems to need much evidence for anything it does, like, for example, accusing UNRWA of being full of Hamas operatives. That now widely discredited claim was made on the same day that the International Court of Justice found it plausible that Israel is committing a genocide in Gaza. And it led to many countries, including the UK, pulling funds from UNRWA. That's the largest humanitarian agency operating in Gaza. But now that decision by the UK government is set to face a legal challenge. A British Palestinian man has said he will launch a judicial review if the government doesn't restore funding to UNRWA by the beginning of April. The parents of the man, who isn't being named, live in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, where famine is imminent and where they're wholly reliant on humanitarian assistance. And to discuss this very interesting, very important case, I'm joined now by Jonathan Purcell, Senior Public Affairs and Communications Officer at the International Centre for Justice for Palestinians. They're funding the legal challenge against the government. Thank you so much for joining us this evening, Jonathan. Can I start by asking you, I suppose we talked on this show about why it was morally wrong for the government to withdraw their funding of UNRWA without a decent amount of evidence. Could you sort of explain why it was, or why it might have been legally wrong as well?
We're looking into a judicial review now. So a judicial review can take place when the government has acted irrationally without due concern. What we're saying is that the government has acted irrationally in ignorance of frameworks it has set itself. So, for instance, there's the Foreign Office's International Humanitarian Framework, which commits the UK to work with its partners, including UNRWA, to prioritise people with the greatest needs in the way they can best meet that need. As you said, UNRWA is the biggest aid provider in the area, and it is clearly the best way to meet that need. So to us, it's broken its own framework and acted irrationally, which opens it up to judicial review. But the government is also at risk of complicity in Israel's violations of international law. If, as is alleged, Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war, as part of its genocide, then the UK could be falling foul of abetting those acts. And at the very least, it's failing in its duties to prevent genocides under Article 1 of the Genocide Convention. And the Genocide Convention is a very important point to make. As a State Party member, the UK has an obligation to prevent genocides when it is aware that there is a risk of genocide happening. Not when they're aware of it definitely happening. All they need to be aware of is a risk. And it's worth reminding that literally the day before the government decided to cut funding, the International Court of Justice found that Israel's actions in Gaza could plausibly amount to genocide. So the UK was aware of the risk of genocide when they took the decision to defund UNRWA, and so it may be at risk of failing in its duties under the Genocide Convention as well. Canada, Australia, and Sweden have restored UNRWA funding now, so it's unclear to us why the UK is still dragging their heels. We think that the government needs prioritising saving lives over saving face.
Did we have an idea of the material impacts, or if there are material impacts yet, of this cutting of funding from UNRWA? Because obviously, you know, one might think that, you know, the real difficulty in Gaza isn't so much the availability of money, but the sort of the possibility of getting anything across that border. So does the withdrawal of money from UNRWA, has it had material impacts already, or is this something that we might think will be more significant going into the future?
Yeah, it's a good question. And it's absolutely true that not much is getting into Gaza at the moment. We all know that. UNRWA and other aid providers too have only been able to provide a slither compared to what is actually needed because Israel is blocking aid from getting in. It was only 2 days ago, on Monday, Israel definitively barred UNRWA from providing aid to northern Gaza, which is where the risk of famine is highest. So, yes, there is incredible urgency in ensuring that the aid gets in right now, with so much of the population facing famine. And there's another discussion to be had about how the UK government should ideally be putting more pressure on Israel to allow aid in beyond simple lip service. But also, as you've said there, defunding UNRWA will have a lasting impact too. And that's both on Gaza and on the wider region. So the European Commission Vice President, Joseph Borrell, he called the sudden withdrawal of funding an existential risk. And only yesterday that proved potentially worryingly true. UNRWA said that they only have enough funding to last until May. The UK should not be playing any role in the potential collapse of the main aid funder in Gaza. And there's also, of course, a knock-on effect for the region too. So only around one third of UNRWA's operations tend to be in Gaza. It's already having a material impact on operations in Jordan, in Lebanon, in the occupied West Bank, and elsewhere. So we can already see these concrete impacts, and these will only grow with time. Damage has already been done, and there isn't time to waste, so funding must be restored now, and that's why we felt the need to take this action.
And finally, I wanted to ask a sort of more general question about this conflict and the law, because, you know, maybe it's just that I haven't been paying attention, but this to me seems like the international conflict where there has been sort of the most legal challenges, where sort of lawyers have been most active in taking governments to court, for example, and obviously this is in the international courts as well. I mean, are we seeing a sort of exceptional amount of sort of legal battles over the course of this conflict? And if so, why?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and you're certainly not the first person to say that to me. I mean, Israel's war on Gaza has opened a can of worms in terms of the rules-based international order. We've been told that law, domestically and internationally, is applied without fear nor favour. But with Israel's war on Gaza, countries, more often than not from the global north, are reluctant to apply the same principles to this conflict as others we've seen in recent years. And many people have made that point. Israel often claims it is uniquely and unfairly singled out for its human rights abuses, but really the opposite is true. Time and time again, Israel is uniquely exempted from the standards that other countries are held to in international law, and Palestinians are uniquely deprived of their rights. If there has been an increase in legal cases in relation to this, I think it's because people are getting tired. Whether that be countries like South Africa, NGOs like ICJP, or grassroots cases, I think the world is simply starting to demand an equal application of the principles of international law to Israel, just like any other country. It really shouldn't be a big ask. It's what we've been told is what the principles of international law is founded on. I mean, day in, day out, people are seeing these horrors unfold on their phones, and they understandably want accountability for what they're seeing. And that's what this case is all about. We're doing our best to ensure that those responsible are held accountable and those complicit are held accountable.
Let's go straight on to our next story. We'll be coming back to Palestine at the end of the show. British people are less satisfied at the NHS than at any time since records began in 1983. That's the message from the British Social Attitudes Survey, which asked the public the same set of questions every year. It's very bad news for the Tories, of course, heading into an election year. And you can see it sort of really when you compare it to the historical perspective. So this is how satisfaction with the NHS has changed over the last 40 years. So on this chart, the red line shows the percentage of people dissatisfied with the NHS. The purple line shows people who are satisfied. So as you can see, in the 1980s and early 1990s, there's a similar number of people who were satisfied and were dissatisfied, each answer getting between 30 and 50%, sort of flipping up and down. And then Labour get into power, and from the early noughties, satisfaction with the NHS just goes up every year until it hits a high of 70% in 2011. So they had a very good story to tell, actually. After the Tories are elected, it falls slightly, and then it collapses during and after the COVID pandemic. Now only 24% of people say they are satisfied with the NHS. Pretty grim statistics. What's driving them? People are still quite satisfied with outpatient care. More people saying satisfied than dissatisfied. But when it comes to general practice and accident and emergency, many more people are saying dissatisfied than satisfied. And then when we get to dentistry and social care, people are just really, really unhappy with the NHS. So we got people who are unhappy. Why are they unhappy now? What should be done? Well, lots of think tanks will tell you it's complicated, but according to the public, it's actually very simple. So this is from the King's Fund and the Nuffield Trust, who analysed the British Social Survey data. They say, despite the challenges the NHS is currently facing, the public are not looking for changes to the principles of the NHS. They do not want a different model. They want the one they've got. They are clear they want to see improvements in waiting times for services, funding, and the number of NHS staff. Despite the current challenging economic climate, nearly half of the public, 48%, support the government increasing taxes to spend more on the NHS. So pretty clear, people want the NHS, they just want it to be better funded. And most of them, or 48% of them, are willing to stump up more taxes to do so. Now, you'd imagine there's also a don't know option. So I would assume that at 48%, you'd have more people saying they're willing to stump up more taxes than people who are actively saying they're not. This, of course, all means the pressure is on Labour to come up with the goods if they get in at the next election. John Curtis, by the way, said a 99% chance that Keir Starmer will be the next Prime Minister. While we wait for that, though, we should make sure to listen to the stories of the many, many people who have really suffered from this crisis in the NHS. Matthew Hulbert lost his mother after a poor experience with the NHS in 2022. He spoke earlier today to the BBC.
She was a wonderful mother, a beloved grandmother, a wonderful person who we all miss so much. And what happened was that in July 2022, she fell at her home in Barwon in Leicestershire in the early hours. We got to her. She said she'd hurt her ribs, so obviously we didn't move her. We called for an ambulance at 5 a.m. and at 4 p.m., 11 hours later, a paramedic arrived in a car, further called for an ambulance. My mum was taken to hospital, where she died 2 days later after an infection turned to sepsis.
I'm sorry to hear about that. And you were with her throughout the process. You know, some of the issues that have come out in this survey, long waiting times, staff shortages, did you see those play out during her treatment?
Well, what I subsequently learned from East Midlands Ambulance Service, because I wrote to them saying, I'm not complaining, but I just want to know what pressures you were facing on that day. What they said was that ambulances were backed up outside the Leicester Royal Infirmary, unable to deliver the patients that they had in the back of the ambulances and the into the hospital. And the reason for that was that there were patients in hospital who were well enough to come home, who were well enough to come home, but who didn't have the care package at home, and so couldn't leave the hospital. And so, you know, as you can tell, it was a whole system issue that ended up failing my mum.
So I found that answer quite moving, right? So clearly it seems that poor care from the NHS seems to be responsible for the death of that guy's mother, right? Really, really tragic, traumatic experience to go through. And then he writes to the NHS and he's very clear to say, when he emailed them, he said, "I'm not complaining, but I just want to know what pressures you were under that day." So he's sort of not looking for a healthcare worker to blame. He's saying, I'm sure you did the best you could, right? But I want to know what might have been the broader structural reasons why this tragedy, it's a tragedy, happened, right? And then they told him, you know, it was taking a very long time for ambulances to unload, which would have meant it took a long time for the ambulance to get to his mother. And then he's clear that they said this was partly because they couldn't discharge people because of problems in social care. So really interesting answer. I think it showed a lot of sort of compassion and grace whilst also really isolating what actually is the problem and with healthcare in this country at the moment. Dahlia, your thoughts on this, the NHS being, you know, the most dissatisfied people have been in 40 years since records began.
Yeah, I mean, people are dissatisfied with the NHS because it doesn't function as an NHS should. When we talk about why the NHS exists, the kind of ideology that is behind a public healthcare sector, it's not just about care being free at the point of use. That's not the only thing that a public health, that's not the only reason that we have a public health sector, or the only reason to have a public health sector. It also emerges from an understanding that healthcare, a service like healthcare, as essential as healthcare, should be ring-fenced away from the private sector, that should be protected from commercial interests, because more often than not, those commercial interests do not align with the interests of providing good healthcare, particularly, you know, when we're talking about taking care of people. And one of the instances that were mentioned in that story is the dysfunction of our social care system, the inadequacy of our social care system, which, by the way, is privatized more explicitly. Looking after elderly people, looking after people who are not considered economically active, in an effective way, looking after them in a dignified way, is not compatible with commercial interests. It's not compatible with the interests of a for-profit model. And so what we are seeing by the fact that the NHS and also its satellite services, such as social care, being splintered, being divided, and being sold off piece by piece to the private sector, whether it is those satellite services like social care, or, you know, discrete processes like community health visits, or even GP surgeries, which essentially now function as private entities. When you introduce that logic through the back door, it affects the quality of care. And that is the thing that people are dissatisfied with. And unfortunately, I don't think that the Conservative Party, or even frankly, the right wing of the Labour Party, who started this whole process of selling off parts of the NHS to the private sector, or part of our healthcare system to the private sector, they are not going to be spooked by statistics like this, because it plays into their agenda that by underfunding and making the NHS as it is delivering poor quality care, they can then make the argument that the reason is because it is wholly unrealistic to have an effective, people-orientated public healthcare system to begin with. Now, what they might be disappointed by, what they might be frustrated by, is that nuance that a lot of people are still able to retain, which is that, yes, the NHS is in a bad state and is in dire straits, but the answer to that is not to abandon the idea of a public health service completely. In fact, it's the opposite. It's to make it more of a publicly funded entity, to increase taxes, to fund it, and to centralize the management and the administration of the NHS, and its satellite services that have been sold off to the private sector. So their only frustration is not going to be in the fact that people are dissatisfied. It's in the fact that people are dissatisfied and yet are holding a nuanced analysis of why they are dissatisfied. So what I can imagine the Conservatives will look at this data and think about is not how do we increase satisfaction levels in the NHS, but rather how do we grind people down enough that they abandon the nuanced analysis that they instinctively had and out of desperation consent to, or at least not resist so strongly, the increased selling off and parceling off of the NHS to private entities. Because let's not forget, you know, the healthcare consumer market in this country has a potential to be huge. You know, we have huge economic inequality, which means that we have, you know, a relatively decent number of people who are very high earners. And those high earners, you know, if you can release that market in, you know, you will, there are shareholders, investors that will make huge amounts of money from that. So I'm glad that that nuance is still being held onto, but what fills me with dread is the fact that I don't think that the Conservatives or even the right wing of the Labour Party, who are likely to lead in the next election, are going to look at this as anything other than an invitation to further break that, the affective relationship that people have with the NHS and the fundamental belief that people still have in the idea of a publicly funded healthcare sector.
In terms of that analysis about the Labour Party, so you're sort of saying you don't trust the Labour right with the NHS. And I think, you know, the Labour right will probably. I mean, Wes Streeting has been saying, you know, the more involvement of the private sector is not going to be a problem for him, really. I mean, he's saying he wants to stop using private healthcare. He wants it all to be within the NHS, but you would still be contracting stuff out, for example. Now, that is what the Labour Party did between 1997 and 2010. And we've sort of just seen the statistics, you know, satisfaction in the NHS went from, I mean, I haven't got it right in front of me now, but it was sort of below 50%, right up to 70%. So you sort of see every year it was increasing and increasing and increasing. So it seems to me that New Labour on the NHS did get something right. And I suppose also I'm a bit more agnostic. I think it should absolutely be funded by taxpayers and absolutely be free at the point of delivery. But in terms of, if you look at, on an international perspective, we have way less private involvement than any other, pretty much any other country in the world. And we have not amazing health outcomes. We should definitely keep the NHS. That's what the people are saying, and they're absolutely right to say that. But do you have some reforms here or there? I don't think it is so black and white as, you know, if it's not all completely nationalised, it's because people are trying to cream off some profit. I mean, I think, you know, probably some of those Labour reformers, those new Labour reformers, were interested in patient outcomes, and they actually did achieve some pretty decent things. It's shown in the stats. I suppose you're more cynical about sort of any possibility of NHS reform and what, say, Wes Streeting might do, let's say.
Well, I think that the NHS does need to change in a sense. I think that, you know, it wouldn't make sense for our public healthcare system to look the exact same now as it did in the 1940s and 50s. But I think when you start to allow this idea that the way that it should change should be in a way that also just happens to make a bunch of people really wealthy, then you have a problem. And when you start to, I think what I'm also concerned about when it comes to parceling off and in the way that it's happening, which is not wholesale selling off, but kind of privatizing little individual bits, you end up getting this incredibly incohesive and splintered system, which means that A, you get very, very uneven levels of healthcare delivery from area to area, and you get very little cohesion between different parts of the healthcare sector. So what we see in, you know, and the same goes as well for childcare in a sense, and the difference between the New Labour childcare model and the kind of contemporary childcare model is this fantasy of a public-private partnership when it comes to something as integral as public health, but also something, you know, if we're looking kind of philosophically at like what healthcare is, it's not just about providing like, you know, patchwork services. If we want to move towards a healthcare model that is more holistic, that is more friendly to people with, you know, to disabled people, to elderly people, people who are not considered to be, you know, economically active, you know, when we talk about disabled people, we're talking about people with particular disabilities, then once you let that logic bleed in, when it comes to whether or not the decision is going to be public welfare or private interest, it's very difficult to see why the public healthcare argument would win. And I think that obviously what New Labour was doing is much better than what the Conservative Party have done now. But I would also argue that the introduction of that logic by New Labour, and the same goes for the childcare sector, it paves the way for this kind of vulturistic approach to then be embedded when the Conservatives do inevitably get back into power.
I want to go to a comment with a statistic that's really sort of taken me by surprise. And Stephen, our researcher, has checked it and says that it does seem to be true for England, but it seems completely wild to me. So GPs see 30 million patients or have 30 million appointments, excluding vaccinations, per month. So that's sort of the equivalent of half the UK population seeing their GP every month. It does seem very surprising to me, but yeah, you've said it. Stephen's saying it's true. I have to work out in my head how that can possibly make sense. You must have a lot of people seeing the GP a lot of times every month. I mean, obviously, you know, that's not a problem. People have chronic illnesses, but it does seem a surprising statistic to me. Let's go on to our next story. Some similar themes, in fact. There is now more sewage in England's seas, lakes and rivers than in any time since records began. And that's according to the latest figures from the Environment Agency released today. Private water companies dumped raw sewage into England's waterways for 3.6 million hours last year. That's double the duration in 2022. Back then, we saw 1.8 million hours of discharges. There were more than 460,000 sewage spills across the country. The number of spills has increased by 50% on 2022, when there were just over 300,000 spills. And there were more spills last year than in every year since 2016, when water companies began reporting the length of spillage events. Water companies and the government are scrambling to explain away this increase in spills. This was Minister for Science, Andrew Griffith, talking to ITV.
We're discovering more than we ever did before. In 2010, when the government came into power, just seven out of every 100 of these storm overflows was measured. So for 93% of those pipes, those overflows, there was no measurement. We didn't know what was going on. So in many ways, you know, slightly good news, I understand that's an odd thing to say, but the good news is we understand this problem now and we are tackling it.
Was there some truth in that, right? In 2013, the Tories introduced rules forcing water companies to monitor spills. And since then, they have been rolling out monitoring devices to more and more spill sites. But by 2022, the Environment Agency said they already had monitors on 91% of spillage sites. So it's hard to see how an increase in monitoring could account for the 50% rise in spills since then. If you've got 9% more monitoring equipment and then the spills go up by 50%, clearly the spills have also increased, right? This issue is, of course, emotive. It's also become politically toxic for the Tories, leading Labour to try and take advantage last year. And they tabled a bill that they said would force water companies to clean up their act or face steep fines. Naturally, as you'd imagine, the Tories blocked it. They said the Labour plan was uncosted and promised to enact their own plan to hold water companies accountable. But that plan, that alternative plan, has so far not materialised. But the government did announce last month a consultation on blocking bonuses for water bosses when criminal breaches of the environmental rules occur. So no bonuses if your company's done a crime doesn't, to me, seem like something that you'd need a consultation for. It seems like that should probably be a given. But presumably, you know, the people smarter than me will know it's not as simple as that. What do the water companies say? Well, they're blaming last year's wet weather for the increase, with 2023 being the sixth rainiest year on record. Meanwhile, 2022 was a particularly dry year with a sustained period of drought across the summer. So again, this isn't a crazy argument. Water companies are allowed to use storm overflows to release sewage when there's heavy rainfall. If there's heavier rainfall than usual, they'll naturally need to do that more often. And if it was particularly dry the year before, then obviously the contrast will be very large. However, it does remain the case and that these companies are only supposed to use storm overflows in exceptional circumstances. So think a major storm, not just because the annual rainfall is a bit higher. Here's what Clean Water campaigner Virgil Sharkey thought about the water company's excuse.
Trying to blame the weather is the lamest excuse that anybody's ever come up with. It almost, you're now moving into the dog ate my homework kind of territory. Let me remind viewers of what has now confirmed the regulator. Water companies have a legal obligation to build, operate, maintain a properly functioning sewage system, and one that does not spend the better part of 14 million hours over the last 5 years dumping sewage into our rivers. Now, here's the real kick of what's also confirmed, and the water companies have now admitted. We, as customers, have provided all of the funding they ever needed for 33 years to meet that legal obligation and do your job. So at the point that we should be exploring, they have paid their shareholders £72 billion in dividends. They have now saddled these companies with £60 billion in debt. And you're all right. The real outrage we should have here is the lack of government oversight, the complete and utter failure of the regulatory system to protect customers and the environment. And you are right, these water companies, the directors, should, in my opinion, now be personally and collectively held liable. And if that means going to jail, then they should go to jail.
It's a well-put argument, isn't it? And Sharkey is very much right about shareholder dividends. United Utilities, which operates in the Northwest, saw the highest number of sewage spills in 2023. And yet it paid out more in dividends to shareholders last year than it gained in profits, with £113 million paid out. So that's the worst performing company in the country. The next worst offender was Yorkshire Water. It paid out £62 million in dividends after recording over £500 million of profit in the 2022 to 2023 year. Most of that money went to shareholding foreign companies, including the Singapore Sovereign Wealth Fund, a country smart enough to have a sovereign wealth fund. The third worst for sewage spills was Severn Trent Water. And guess what? They paid out a lot of dividends as well in this case, £260 million to shareholders. That was more than half of its pre-tax profits, which were £500 million. The water industry says it is planning to spend £96 billion up to the end of this decade on tackling spills and leaks. So that is a lot of money. But they've been criticised for passing that cost on to customers while paying out huge dividends to shareholders and massive bonuses to their own executives. I'm joined now by Kat Hobbs, founder and director of We Own It, who campaigned for public ownership. Thanks for joining us, Kat. And can we start by saying, it's still not completely clear to me, to what extent are these spillages, we talk about record spillages, to what extent is this genuinely because spillages have increased? And to what extent is it because we're monitoring it now? You know, when you sort of look at that very steep curve from 2013 onwards, it does seem like some of that is just that we've put monitoring devices on more sort of spill sites, let's say.
The water companies up until very recently have been effectively marking their own homework. And so, yes, we have more data now. There is more monitoring. The Environment Agency is correct about that. However, the situation is absolutely untenable. You know, what we've seen in the past year is more than a doubling of sewage spills. So that's a completely unacceptable situation. You know, 3.6 million hours worth of sewage flowing into our rivers and seas. And from our perspective, you know, we campaign at We Own It for public ownership. What on earth would it take for the government to decide to bring these water companies into public ownership? Because the government has special administration powers to use if water companies don't perform. Well, they're not performing. So now would be the moment. You know, there's lots of excuses floating around, you know, heavy rain. You know, sometimes it's heavy rain that they can't cope with because apparently they can't predict the weather. Other times, you know, it's not raining enough and there's drought, so they have to have a hose pipe ban. These privatized water companies are working for their shareholders, and they're not working for the British public or the English public, and they're not working for the environment. And the result of that is we have unswimmable rivers and seas that people can't use. It's degrading our quality of life. And the impact on wildlife is absolutely astonishingly awful. And yet these water companies just get away with a slap on the wrist and a small fine, which from their perspective is like pocket change. You know, it's the cost of doing business. So the situation that we have here, you know, yes, we're being given all the kind of ins and outs of, oh, we're finally monitoring sewage. Okay, great. How about we run these companies in public ownership the way the rest of the world does and hold them accountable for cleaning up our rivers?
I want you to bear with me while we play another clip because I want your response to this. So to stop our sewage system overflowing, and we're ultimately going to need new and bigger sewers. And the BBC had a report this morning on a new London sewer opening soon.
The super sewer has been designed and built to intercept the frequent spills of untreated sewage into the tidal Thames. It's going to have a profound effect on the health of the river.
Snaking its way underneath the bends of the Thames, the super sewer can hold 600 Olympic-sized swimming pools of sewage and rain.
Okay, it looks like it's getting dark up here.
Last year, I bicycled with Andy along the 7-metre-wide tunnel.
Here we are at the Victoria interception point, which is this connection tunnel here.
This sort of mega project doesn't come cheap. The super sewer has cost about £5 billion to build, and that's going to be paid for by Thames Water customers through their bills. And that's the reality for the rest of the UK as well. If we want to stop sewage spilling into our rivers and seas, water companies and the government have been very clear that it's all of us who are going to have to pay for it.
I'm very much looking forward to the London super sewer opening. Kat, that report sort of ended by saying, you know, the government and the water companies have been clear. If we need new sewers, I mean, we definitely do, I think, need investment in loads of new sewers, right? We've still got a Victorian sewage system. The reason these overflows happen is because the rainwater goes in the same place as the toilet water. And then when it all gets, you know, there's too much of it, it comes over. So we're going to need more sewers. Who will have to pay for them, in your view?
We will have to pay for them. The customers, the households, the public, we will have to pay for them. It has always been the case that that's where the money has come from. So investment since privatisation has actually gone down 15%. Every decade, the shareholders have been putting in less. And Catherine Ross, who has worked for both Thames Water and for the regulator, Ofwat, said very clearly last summer, this will have to come from customers' bills. So since privatisation, our bills have gone up by 40%. Thames Water in particular is now pushing, because it's got a debt problem, it's now pushing for bills to be allowed to go up by up to 40%. So we're paying for it. And, you know, if you look at the track record of these companies, $83 billion has gone out in dividends since privatisation. They've built up a $60 billion debt mountain. And so 20p of every pound that you spend in your water bills is going just to pay for that debt, to service the debt that these water companies have got themselves into. They leak away around a fifth of all water. You know, and of course the sewage, it is unbelievable the amounts that they're allowing to be poured into our rivers and seas. So the track record is absolutely horrendous. But yes, the key point is every penny of investment that goes into fixing the problems is paid for by us. So what exactly are the private shareholders who are mostly abroad in, as you mentioned, Singapore, Malaysia, Australia, Canada, what are they bringing to the party? Really absolutely nothing. The investment that they make is in us, right? Because we're the captive market. We have to pay our bills. They get to talk to the regulators behind the scenes in cozy conversations about how much our bills will go up. And then they get a guaranteed flow of income. So that's a great investment for them, but it's not the way to fix the problems with our water infrastructure in this country.
So enthusiastic about the super sewer as I am. Nick Mack says, I don't want to pay for a London sewer. And then Starman says, Thames water is like bleach. Lots of hating on our water system. The shareholders get too much, but I would like to be able to swim in the rivers. finally, Kat. Labour are going to get into, according to John Curtis, there's a 99% chance that Labour will be in government within the year. What do you see them doing? I mean, they've been pretty clear they don't want to nationalise the water companies. If they've ruled that out, what else could they do? What would you want to be seeing from them?
So Labour is absolutely wrong to rule it out. There's various ways that it could happen. It may be forced upon them if Thames Water collapses. And it should not be the case that Thames Water gets passed back to a private company. That would be an absolute outrage. It should be transferred to public ownership. They could be, instead of fining water companies, they could be taking shares from water companies so that gradually we're bringing these incompetent organisations into public ownership. And finally, as I mentioned at the start, obviously they could be promising to use, and the Lib Dems are talking about this, special administration powers, where they're saying, actually, your performance isn't up to scratch and we're taking you into public hands. What Labour is saying instead is, oh, we're going to penalise bosses a bit more. We're not going to allow bosses bonuses. Well, the CEOs of water companies are already on around £2 million salaries. But actually, it's a real diversion to be talking about whether they get an additional bonus or not. I mean, this doesn't solve the problem of the debt mountain. It doesn't solve the problem of the billions of pounds flowing out in dividends to shareholders. It doesn't solve the lack of accountability around our water companies. And really, Labour should be being much braver and looking at what's happening in Scotland. Scottish Water is in public ownership. Scotland invests 35% more than England in its infrastructure. That's £72 more per household per year. If we in England had invested at that rate, an extra £28 billion would have gone into the infrastructure. We can't go on like this with our rivers and seas full of raw sewage. So why don't we look at how other countries do it and move away from this ideological model of running water that clearly, so clearly from the data that we've seen today, does not work.
And then everyone can have a super sewer. It shouldn't just be Londoners that get a new super sewer. Kat Hobbs, thank you so much for joining us this evening. The pollution caused by sewage doesn't just make our waterways and seas disgusting. It causes the overgrowth of algae, which starves rivers and streams of oxygen. That kills aquatic creatures. It also means that some of the byproducts of our own human habits get passed on to marine life. Professor of Biology Alex Ford has been studying the effects of sewage spills on Langston Harbour in Hampshire. He described his findings to Good Morning Britain.
The sewage treatment plant behind us takes in the waste of 500,000 people. And when it can't cope with it, it chucks it straight out here. And in the marine life, just beneath our feet, we're actually finding they're full of drugs. They're full of contraceptive pill, antidepressants, anti-anxiety medication. Every single marine species that we've looked at so far is full of cocaine.
So cocaine, birth control pills, antidepressants, quite a cocktail for some shellfish. That finding about cocaine had Susanna Reid, not to mention the rest of us, intrigued.
Richard, can I just ask you to clarify with your expert there, if your expert is still there? Every marine species is full of cocaine, did he say? What?
Yeah, so Alice, they're just asking about the cocaine that you've found. I mean, you're sampling these marine species and you're finding that what's in the sewage water ends up in those species.
Yeah, exactly. The drugs affect this wildlife in the same way that they do us. So if you give a fish contraceptive pill, it starts to feminize. If you give crabs antidepressants, it changes their behavior because those drugs were designed to change behavior. So if you give them illegal drugs as well, it has very much the same effect it has on them that it would do on people as well.
But the fact that you're finding it in them shows there's quite a high concentration of nasty stuff coming out of that pipe.
Most certainly. And obviously it's all joined together. So these species don't get exposed to just one of these compounds, they get exposed to all of them at the same time.
And that is obviously having a worrying effect on the ecosystem here, not just around the Portsmouth area, but right the way around the British coastline.
They're getting a drugs cocktail, basically.
Oh my God, I can't believe that Richard Madeley's response was the same as mine before we played the second part of the clip. That's very worrying. I love the question. Alex, they're asking about the cocaine you found. Are shellfish in sort of our river estuaries, are they the real winners from the privatization of our sewage systems?
I mean, look, I went to a football match. Surprisingly, I do like to go to football matches every so often because I like to do some communal shouting. And when I came back, the first thing I was said was like, this country has a cocaine problem. Like, I don't know if that makes me unpopular or dorky, but I'm not surprised that our fish are full of cocaine, and generally sounds like their insides look like the floor of Bergheim. And that's a very sad indictment of where we are as a society. The fish don't deserve that.
I just like the idea that he's saying, you know, very matter of fact, you know, if it has this effect on humans, it will also have this effect on crabs. So like a crab on cocaine, it's, you know, I've never seen, can a crab gurn? I don't know. We'll have to get David Attenborough on it. Let's go to our next and final story. Alon Levy has been the face of Israel in the UK throughout its genocidal war on Gaza. That was until last week when he was suspended from his duties as an official Israeli spokesperson. And now it's been confirmed he's been fired. The Jerusalem Post has the reasons. They say this: the government office clarified that the latest incident in which he clashed with British Foreign Secretary David Cameron was the straw that broke the camel's back. The government office listed several additional incidents, including Levy's audition on Dancing with the Stars, which was made without confirming this with his superiors beforehand. Additionally, he posted a video at the beginning of the war that turned out to be fake and mocked Nasrallah and his speechwriter instead of calming tensions. And that's a reference to Hassan Nasrallah. I'm the head of Hezbollah in Lebanon. I think he joked that Israel had killed his speechwriter, and that's why he said his speech was so boring. So diplomatically, not very sensitive. Of course, we can assume the Israelis have not fired Levy for any principled reason, but he will not be missed. And he has, for many, become an updated representative of the banality of evil, justifying the unjustifiable, always with a smug smile on his face. And to mark his departure, we've compiled just some of his worst moments, including spreading lies.
We would say that Hamas beheaded babies and burned whole families alive so that the only thing the forensic pathologists found is two intertwined burned spines. Hamas has placed its main operational command center underneath the Shifa Hospital in Gaza, which is a clear war crime, because they know that Israel doesn't want to hurt civilians and that Israel is urging civilians to get out of harm's way. And by the way, most of them have.
We, of course, now know there were no beheaded babies. And we also know there was no main command center under al-Shifa. But Alon did his job well. He spread the lies which justified a genocidal war. And while Alon justified a genocide, he smeared anyone who disagreed. This was a tweet he sent after that really big protest in London, 500,000 or so people. He said, "I don't think London has ever seen such a large demonstration of rape apologists before." Now, we talked about this tweet at the time. That demonstration was so huge. So many families from across the country, mums there with their kids, and he's called them all rape apologists. It couldn't be more despicable, really. And smearing people standing up for Gazans was not limited to protesters. He also applied the strategy to international agencies.
"We're demanding international accountability now from the global agencies that have said absolutely nothing about Hamas's abuse of hospitals as human shields. I listened to the interview you had just now. The World Health Organization has not condemned Hamas's use of hospitals as human shields once. Not once.
I think we just heard them condemn Hamas.
We just heard them condemn Hamas, right? So he's lying. That's a lie, right? Or he just doesn't have very good listening skills. And that tactic of conflating criticism for Israel with support for Hamas, and more softness on Hamas, and was also applied to the entire nation of South Africa after they took Israel to the World Court.
"The State of Israel emphatically condemns South Africa's decision to play advocate for the devil and to make itself criminally complicit with the perpetrators of the October 7 massacre. The State of Israel will appear before the International Court of Justice at The Hague to dispel South Africa's absurd blood libel. How tragic that the Rainbow Nation that prides itself on fighting racism will be fighting pro bono for anti-Jewish racists."
Now, if you know the history of South Africa and the history of Israel, right, so how dare this history which has fought racism now challenge Israel, right? Israel was one of the last supporters of the apartheid government, sort of doing arms deals with them, essentially. And now you've got a government in South Africa that knows what apartheid looks like, and they're taking Israel to the International Criminal Court. Now, there's quite a straightforward explanation of what's going on here, which is that South Africa cares a lot about apartheid and racism, and that's why they're taking Israel to the court, right? It's completely, really threatening as well. They are now taking part in the crime by taking this to a court. If you're confident in your argument, why not say, okay, yeah, take it to the court, we'll see. If you're trying to threaten people and intimidate them away from taking sort of or seeking legal recourse, what does that say about you? Levy was happy to smear protesters, international agencies, and entire nations, and he was happy to cast aspersions on news anchors as well.
"Everyone who has been killed since October 7th would still be alive if Hamas had not declared war. If Hamas were not fighting this war from densely populated areas, and no one else would be hurt."
Yes, but this didn't
Hamas
start on October 7th
and lay down
in their
its
terms,
arms.
Did it?
You're right.
You know, you can say this would not have happened had October the 7th not happened. They would say October the 7th wouldn't have happened had Israel not occupied Gaza in the first place.
I would be very wary of trying in any way to contextualize the atrocities of October 7th.
Just another threat, right? I would be very wary of contextualizing what happened on October the 7th. Christian Guru Murphy's job is to contextualize things, right? Just as it's a government like South Africa's responsibility if they think that genocide is going on to take it to the ICJ. And he's not saying, you know, that's not a rational argument. That is saying, I am warning you, don't use context. I am warning you, don't go to the ICJ, right? It's a real bullying tactic. And that somewhat threatening approach was repeated on the news agents when he was asked if Israel would abide by international law.
If the ICJ were to rule against you, in the preliminary round, the actual eventual conclusions may take many years, but in terms of their preliminary assessment, will you comply with their stipulations?
We fully expect the ICJ to throw out this spurious claim.
No, but if they don't,
I'm not going to answer absurd hypotheticals.
It's not absurd hypothetical. No, it's either Lewis, yes or no.
It is an absurd hypothetical. Because when you have parents sitting in that courtroom whose children were abducted and being held as hostages, the idea that an international court of justice that is supposed to uphold international law might actually order those parents to stop fighting to bring back their children.
So you'll adhere to a court judgment if they rule your way.
It's an absurd hypothetical.
What kind of kangaroo court would that be?
It's an absurd hypothetical.
Why are you even signatories to the convention if you are unwilling to commit to abide by the means by which that convention is policed and enforced? What is the point?
Lewis, the State of Israel was one of the first signatories to the Genocide Convention. Genocide
and
was
so
defined.
I would have thought that the State of Israel would be the first to say that they would want to see that court stipulations are adhered to for precisely the reason you are referring to.
The State of Israel would like to see international law being applied fairly, understanding that to
the
extent...
In the way that Israel wants.
No, in a way that understands that on October 7th, we were the victims of an act of genocide.
It's sort of just that same sort of unpleasant thing of sort of brushing it off. It's an absurd hypothetical. I'm not going to deal with an absurd hypothetical. Then it gets challenged very effectively. Well, why has Israel even signed this convention if it's not going to abide by the rulings of the court, which is, you know, within this treaty, granted the authority over when or not it's breached? And then it goes, Israel was the first to sign it, you know, one of the first to sign the genocide convention. This sort of like, don't you dare go there. Just came across as sort of uniquely unpleasant. That was Levy's strategy for defending Israel's current actions. And this is really shocking. He was also happy to cover for historic acts of ethnic cleansing.
I'm going to bring you back to the words of those politicians, if I may. We're now actually rolling out the Gaza Nakba. Nakba, the Palestinian term for ethnic cleansing. Those are the words of a government minister your government.
Talk about a little bit of historical context. What the Palestinians refer to as the Nakba.
I'm just asking you about those words.
No, so I want to talk about that word Nakba. When the Palestinians use the word Nakba, they are referring to the consequences of the decision in 1948 to try to scuttle the creation of a Jewish state under the UN General Assembly resolution. They declared war in 1948. That war of annihilation did not go their way, and there were consequences as a result.
So in the Nakba, over 700,000 people were ethnically cleansed, right, driven out of their homes. And this is sort of documented by even historians who are now very much on sort of the pro-Israel side. So Benny Morris, for example, has written about how there was an ethnic cleansing of Palestinians during the Nakba. And Alon Levy's response, well, they lost a war and they had to face the consequences. Presumably we're going to see less of this guy. I mean, we have been seeing less of this guy for the last couple of months. You'll note sort of most of those clips were from October, November, December, January. I think he'd been sort of taken off the rounds for the last month or so, but now he's finally been fired. I mean, what can we learn from sort of watching performances like that from this guy who was born in Britain, went to Oxford University, you know, middle class, very, very well-to-do guy, sort of going out and justifying what, you know, we and most of our audience will find completely unjustifiable?
You know, when I watch Alon Levy, it makes me think of a really disturbing statistic that I saw a few weeks ago, which is that the younger generation in Israel is actually quite significantly more right-wing than the older generation in Israel. And that bucks the trend in most countries and at most historical moments. Normally, the younger generation are more progressive, more left-wing than their elders. But actually, in Israel, 74% of people, Israeli Jews, are consider themselves to be right-wing between the ages of 18 and 25. And then when you go to above 65, 46% of Israeli Jews believe that, consider themselves to be right-wing. So that to me is, first of all, the fact that it is very irregular, but it also to me signifies something extremely concerning, which is that what we see by Alon Levy, and Alon Levy is very much that part of that kind of younger generation of people who sees himself as potentially someone in the future ruling class of Israel, is we see that particularly if this genocide is able to be completed, and even already with this, the fact that, that Israel has been able to go this far and been given such a green light by the global community, we are looking at a future of Israel that is where the consensus for a genocidal and fascistic approach to the Palestinian issue is even more pronounced. If we look at Alon Levy as a kind of portal into the future of Israeli politics, it very much that this kind of approach that he has, which is this complete and utter dismissiveness of any kind of international mechanisms of accountability, this use of intimidation, which is kind of the approach that he goes into a lot of these interviews with, and also this reliance on, not reliance on rights frameworks or legalities or even logic, but reliance on overly evocative and emotive representations of Palestinian people, of their so-called enemies, in order to achieve particular political ends. I think that we are seeing, especially if the global community does not make Israel accountable for what it has done so far, we are seeing the creation of a somehow even more right-wing and fascistic future of Israeli politics that Alon Levy kind of offers a portal into that future in the way that he operates. So even if we never see Alon Levy again, which I think is very unlikely, you know, he is being fired because he is having a minor kind of a domestic political dispute with the current, with the Netanyahus in particular, I think that he is absolutely going to come back into political life. But even if he himself does not come back into political life, the attitude that he has, the politics that he represents, is very much embedded, particularly in the younger generation in Israel, which is extremely concerning.
I mean, that's very well put, Dahlia. Thank you for joining me tonight.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Come back tomorrow for another stream at 6 p.m. For now, you've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.